part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
Fanboy.com.
My name is Christian Horn, and this is the Part-Time Fanboy podcast, and I have a very special guest on the line this week. This is the first film director interview Whoa. That we're doing, I believe, on this podcast. we are... What's that?
That's exciting. That's very exciting.
This is very exciting. Exciting for me. Usually we chat like comic personalities, writers. I've talked to some, you know, animation professionals and stuff like that. But I don't know that I've ever had a full-fledged director slash writer slash producer on this podcast. And I've been selling you long enough. I'm just going to reveal your name. I am speaking with Micah Gallo, correct? I pronounced that correctly, right?
That's right. That's yeah, right.
I'm known for massacring names on this podcast.
There you go. And no, you got it.
I got it. I nailed it correctly. And you are the director currently of a movie that is being, let's just jump straight to it so that people know why you're on the podcast. You are the director of a movie called Itsy Bitsy, correct?
That's right.
Writer, director, producer, and which is currently, are you the producer on that? I'm looking at your internet movie database credits and.
Yeah, I'm a producer, writer, and the director of Itsy Bitsy. And it's a feature film and family suspense drama that's on Kickstarter right now.
Yeah, it's on Kickstarter. So you are looking for funding to complete it or to do the whole thing or.
Yeah, that's right. We're in post-production, which means we've shot the entire movie. We have maybe a half a day of visual effects elements to shoot. On nice. A stage at some point, but other than that, we are looking for money to complete. So looking for money for visual effects and color correction and sound and music, just a little bit to help get us across the finish line.
Yeah, and as of right now, as of this recording, your goal is $40,000 and you've got 28 days to go. By the time this goes up, it'll probably be a little less than that, but you've already nailed a small chunk of that. I mean, a decent percentage. So you guys are roaring out of the gate.
We're at about 30%. So we still definitely need more help and support, but we're really grateful that it's off to a good start.
That's awesome. Congratulations for that. I mean,
thank you.
Statistics kind of like say that, I mean, with what you funded so far, that you would probably meet your goal, which doesn't mean that people shouldn't contribute. Throw all your money at Itsy Bitsy the movie on Kickstarter. don't skip that. But so you and I were connected, and I should thank my friend Ricardo Delgado on the podcast because he has been doing some work for you and with you on this film, correct?
Yeah, Ricardo did all the storyboards because we did a lot of very extensive pre-production planning, and there's a lot of other aspects of the film that, you know, being an independent film that Ricardo has been involved with as well. But yeah, we're just really excited about the Kickstarter campaign, and we got a lot of cool prizes on there and, you know, hoping to get across the finish line.
So why don't we get into a little bit of what the film is about? Obviously we don't want to get into spoilers, and there's an awesome trailer on the Itsy Bitsy Kickstarter. And you guys also have a website, correct? Itsybitsy.com?
It's itsybitsythemovie.com. And right now that pretty much redirects you to the Kickstarter campaign. The best thing to do for information is to join us on Facebook. We have an Itsy Bitsy fan page for the movie. And then we also have a Kickstarter campaign where we're going to have a lot of cool updates and stuff.
Awesome. So I did watch the trailer before we got on together, and as you said, it's a creature movie, but it's also, if the title doesn't clue you in, it seems to deal with spiders, which I, you know, I mentioned to my family that I was interviewing a man who was making a horror movie about spiders, and obviously everyone put the gross out face on. So do you want to talk a little bit about the plot?
Well, yeah, that's very perceptive of you. It's about spiders. Yeah, the
well, the trailer kind of gives it a little bit away, but yeah.
It kind of gives it away, doesn't it? Yeah. And so does the title. But yeah, the it's definitely, you know, more than just your average creature movie. And you know how it is. It's like with horror, to some people, it's a bad word. It's not a bad word to me. I love horror movies, but it's also more of a suspense-filled family drama. And so we really wanted to have these edgy characters and an interesting story to tell, so that it, you know, at the end of the day, you can have all these great scares and cool scenes, but they don't really add up to much unless you've got a good story with good quality acting.
Yeah.
And so we've tried to ground our movie in that, and we spent a lot of, you know, extra time and effort to make sure that we had those elements, that we had a great script, that we worked with good actors and gave them time to do their jobs well.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, Ricardo told me about the project and he told me he was working on it. And I was like, oh, that's great. That's fantastic. But you know, if you've been in LA a very long enough, everybody's got a project, and everybody, and when you've been doing a podcast like this for long enough, there's definitely tons of people doing like Kickstarters that want to either come on, or your support, or money, or whatever. And and so he said, oh yeah, the Kickstarter's going to launch. And I have to say that, you know, I didn't have like any low expectations or anything. Like, obviously Ricardo's a good friend of mine, works on quality stuff. And, but you know, you hear horror, you hear director, you're like, okay, there's a range of quality. But when I went to the Kickstarter page and saw the trailer, I was like, oh, this looks like, this is solid. This looks like really great.
Cool.
Visually and tone wise. So I was very impressed.
Yeah. We spent a lot of time on it. And from a visual standpoint, we spent a lot of time on the visual design. I mean, I even consulted with a film critic friend of mine, and with the storyboards, we really worked out a visual scheme so that there's an actual visual language that reinforces certain aspects of the movie and the various characters, so that when you're watching the movie, hopefully it's not heavy-handed, but you know, in other words, we definitely cared about the craft and the level of you know, visual storytelling that goes into making a good movie. I think we wanted it to exceed those expectations for an independent film. So yeah. Thank you for noticing that.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously there's a grand scope of horror. I mean, I'm a horror fan too. I probably don't watch as much as I used to watch ever since I had a child, because you know, you just don't have time, and you know, I can't sit the kid in front of The Shining and just be like, let's
watch. Yeah, you don't want to start children, I guess. Huh?
Yeah, at least not yet. But you know, there's a lot of people that get away with sort of, obviously, I mean, there's a huge range of like sort of budgetary levels within the horror genre. But I have to say that when I, you know, when I watched your trailer, I mean, it just, it looked like something that money was put into, care was put into. So that got me excited, and that got me to, you know, help donate to it.
Thanks. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, not as much money as any of us who worked on it would have liked, but yeah, hopefully our passion took it the extra mile. And, you know, I've just really been lucky to work with committed people, you know, people who understood the vision of what we were trying to create and cared about the movie and characters almost as much as I did, and were willing to put in that time. And so, you know, we got people that probably our budget didn't technically allow, but they were just on board with what we were doing, which, like you're saying, you know, we're trying to make something that's an elevated movie. It's not just a horror film. It's also a very serious character drama.
Sure,
and
sure.
You know, I think if you look at movies like, you know, you mentioned The Shining, and if you look at Silence of the Lambs and Jaws and The Exorcist, I mean, they're dramas first, mm-hmm. and then they're a horror film. And that's what I think sort of makes it translate to a broader audience.
Yeah. It's interesting because horror does tend to be sort of, I mean, if it's really great horror, it tends to be sort of a mixed genre. You know, I mean, there's, like you said, there can be comedy, there can be, you know, drama, there can be sci-fi. I mean, they can all have these elements that are, you know, horrific, for lack of a better term, that sort of elevate it to this one genre of horror.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's a very broad term, and I think that's why it becomes a bad word in certain circles, because I think it tends to conform to many things. And so it often conforms to whatever, you know, the mass public's current idea of horror is. And so, I mean, I remember for a while it was Saw type movies, which some people dubbed torture porn. So horror became a very bad word for anybody who didn't like torture porn. But like you say, it's so broad and fluid that it can take on almost any meaning. And I think it's something that's in our DNA. I mean, you know, being scared and telling scary stories goes back probably beyond time, you know, to the beginning of time anyway, with human beings. And so, you know, I think that aspect of it runs deep and has mass appeal, always has and always will.
That's funny that you would say that, you know, that I don't, does horror really still have that stigma anymore? Because I mean, look at what just happened, you know, as we record, it just opened in movie theaters like across the country, and it just like smashed records. And then you've got, you know, stuff like Conjuring. I mean, even Fox has like a series, The Exorcist, The Walking Dead. Does it still carry that negative, you know, sort of connotation, horror, or
it does. It does, unfortunately.
Does it really?
You know, not all circles, but in certain circles, it definitely still carries a negative connotation. And it just becomes, for some people, an easy thing to write off, where, oh, it's just a horror movie. And then they don't dig deeper. They don't want to look deeper. But you know, I think it is the responsibility of the filmmaker to make a film that is worthy, to make a film that isn't just, that isn't just hitting those horror beats, but also has something more to offer, you know? And that's why, you know, these other films you mentioned are standouts at the box office, you know, because it and The Conjuring and some of these other films, they're, you know, I mean, some of them have great budgets, and that's obviously a luxury that not every filmmaker has, but they also do care about the story and the characters and, you know, delivering to the audience, not just based on their expectations of horror movies they've seen before, which is important on some level, but giving them something different, something new that maybe they haven't experienced in a theater before.
That's really interesting, because I mean, when we talk negative connotations, like, what are we saying? Are we saying that people are a little reticent to become involved, or reticent to give you money, or it's hard to sort of like get the budget for a horror movie, or actors to get involved? Like, what do you think that sort of negativity surrounding horror movie does, or what challenges does it bring to someone like you, who's like, I want to make a horror movie?
I mean, I suppose it can be all those things. I mean, I honestly, what's great about horror films for first time directors like myself, or, you know, other people who are trying to break into the business, is it transcends the box office rules that a lot of other genres have to live by. And so, I mean, you don't need Tom Cruise to be in your horror movie. It doesn't matter. If you have the right idea and something that catches people's imagination and can transcend language barriers even, then you could end up with a runaway hit if that delivers in a way that meets the audience's expectations. But yeah, there is a little bit of a negative connotation where, I don't know, you know, it really depends on that individual's perception. But I know that some people, whether it be actors or viewers or potentially even people who'd be giving you money or working on your film in some other capacity, unless they understand what you're doing, it's a sensitive area because it's something where you might be doing something that they don't, that their values don't, you know, go along with. It could be something that they find offensive. It always rides this fine line, right? Because I mean, horror is supposed to push those buttons. I mean, you're dealing with things like death, you know, things that are both very personal and very disturbing.
Sure,
okay.
Sure.
And so, I mean, you could easily rub somebody the wrong way depending on what you're doing. Now, horror fans, you know, true horror fans, I mean, you know, it doesn't matter to them. They want their buttons to be pushed, but not every individual is that way. And so it's a delicate dance between making something that is appealing and has these other dimensions, not just horror, and also delivering those scares to both horror fans and maybe people that don't usually watch horror films. And you know, that's the type of film that we're wanting to make. We want to hopefully have a broad appeal, but we, you know, we want our characters to be strong. We feel like having a good character drama is the best insurance policy for a movie, because that's the type of thing that people come back to. They want to watch, you know, interesting characters and have a good story and also have fun, you know, while they watch it.
So do you think maybe as a first-time filmmaker, I mean, it seems like looking at your sort of credits on the Internet Movie Database, I see a decent amount of horror movies. It seems mm-hmm. like you work in visual effects, a big chunk of your credits, but I mean, The Innkeepers, that was a really good movie. I don't think I've seen Frozen or Hatchet. I'm just looking at like what the first titles that pop up, like these little graphics.
Yeah.
But as far as making your first film, would it have been easier for you to say like, I'm going to make a comedy, I'm going to make a drama?
No.
I mean, or is
no,
it-
that's what I'm saying is I don't think it is, because I think that if you're a first time filmmaker, if you're making a comedy or a drama, the financial reality today is that in order to make something that stands out in the marketplace and is worthy of investment, right, which is like part of the unfortunate process of making a movie, is you have to raise money from
sure.
somebody. And in order to secure their investment, they want to know what elements are attached to make it marketable. And if you're making a drama or a comedy, you pretty much need a celebrity to be in your movie in order to, you know, make it viable, or at least make it a slam dunk. You can risk it without it, but it is very risky. As opposed to a horror film, you have more of an opportunity to potentially create something that has a breakaway success and has international appeal just through the concept alone.
Yeah.
So yeah, that, and, you know, in terms of the movies that I was working on, I mean, yeah, we were running I built a business called Lit Post with, a partner, Tyler Haas, who's also working with me on this film. And in order to get business, you know, it's like, that was the low hanging fruit. I mean, a lot of what goes on in Hollywood, you know, it's hard to get your foot in the door in any business.
Sure.
And so we were able to get those kinds of movies because they were made for lower budgets, and because they were sometimes first-time filmmakers or filmmakers who were willing to take a chance on, you know, a more unproven company. And we were able to build up a reputation for ourselves in that business. And I'm sure if I continued in that business, we would have a different level of clientele now. But yeah, that's what's great about genre movies, is there's a lot of opportunity in them. You know what I mean? For people working behind and in front of the camera, if you're, you know, willing to go there and work on the right projects.
Oh, it's really interesting, because again, looking at everything you've done, it seems to me you're sort of going the Deadpool route, the sort of like Tim Miller route, where, you know, from what I understand of the director of Deadpool, he was sort of a visual effects guy or owned a visual effects company or worked on, you know, visual effects and then went on to sort of direct Deadpool. Oh, okay. Not saying that your movie is Deadpool, but I'm just saying, you know, whether you like Deadpool or not, I don't, you know, you know, I'm just saying that it seems like you've really sort of, again, you said kind of built your reputation doing visual effects and stuff like that. And now you're making the transition to directing. Is directing something you always wanted to do?
Yeah. I mean, I went to school to be a director, and even before I, the way I met my business partner in Lit Post was I was directing a short film called Wick that was based on a feature script that I wrote. And so I was always a director first and foremost. And I guess the way that I looked at it was, you know, building that business and getting the experience of working on over 40 feature films was better than working at Starbucks for me.
Sure.
Because then I'm interacting with, you know, other people in the business, and I'm learning too. I'm learning from some of the mistakes and some of the things that were done well on these other independent movies that were made for, you know, similar budgets to what I'm working with here. And so it's all applicable. All those lessons that I learned from working on other people's movies was a huge benefit to me here on this film. So.
And so you've written several things. Where did the idea, when did you come up with the idea for Itsy Bitsy? Is it something recent, or is it something that you had percolating in the back of your head for years and years and years? How did that sort of develop in your head?
Yeah, I mean, I at least had the idea 10 years ago, maybe more.
Oh, wow.
And, but then, you know, you get busy with things and it takes time. It takes time to develop, for me anyways, it takes me time to develop ideas.
Sure.
And so I developed the idea, and I was also fitting in writing in between, you know, my full-time jobs.
Sure.
So I'd come home at night and work on it. And that transitioned from me working alone to working with a friend of mine who was a writer. We did several drafts together, you know, wrote it, tore it down, rewrote the whole thing. And then, so that took a couple years. And then basically not too long before I decided to start shooting, which was back in 2016, was our first shoot. And, so leading up to that in 2015, I worked with, another writer, and, we worked together to kind of freshen it up a little bit. So it was really a collaboration between me and two other guys, those two other guys being Jason Alvino and Brian Dick. Uh-huh. And so, yeah, we worked together to create the script. And then of course, once you're in production, things change a little bit, and working with the actors, that changes the script. And then of course in editing, you know, as they say, that's the final rewrite. So once again, it kind of, goes through another iteration, or goes through some transformations from that process too.
Sure, sure. So, but what was the impetus to do a full-on feature for you? Because, I mean, it seems like you're working in visual effects for a while. You made a couple of shorts. There must have been something in you at some point where you were like, I just got to do it. Like, at this point, like, here we go. I'm finally going to do it. Like, what pushed you to say, like, okay, now I'm going to do a feature? Because, like you said, you could have comfortably probably been sitting in your, you know, in your business doing what you were doing and, you know, making shorts and stuff like that. There must have been something that sort of, like, kind of, like, kicked you in the rear and made you go, like, okay, I'm going to make a feature, and it's going to be this. It's going to be Itsy Bitsy.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, it's what I came here to do, and it was one of those ideas that just kept slapping me in the face. I mean, I would have dreams about it, and I would hear about other spider projects or something, and I mean, it was just always there in the back of my mind, you know, and it just felt like a slap in the face every time, like, why haven't you done this yet?
Yeah.
And look, I mean, there's no money in short films, And even if working on other people's movies had made me a multimillionaire, which it did not, it wouldn't have been satisfying to me on the same level as making a movie, because that's what I came here to do. That's what I've been training to do pretty much my whole life, or at least, you know, half my life.
Sure.
And so, yeah, I mean, I just decided at some point that there was no perfect time. You know, I have a kind of a perfectionist brain, and I realized that the only way that that perfectionism has any value to myself or society is in motion. In other words, I have to be doing something. I can't be sitting on the couch, waiting, biding my time. It's pointless. It's useless. And I can see the hours dripping out of my life like sand.
Oh God!
You know, it's like we're just these human candles burning away.
I identify with that. Yes, go on.
Yeah. And so you know, essentially, like, I just realized there will never be a perfect moment. There's only when you decide that, you know, you have to go after what you want. And you know, I think, you know, another person that inspired me a lot was David Lynch, and you hear him talking about it, and you know, the way that he talks about filmmaking, and I think you could see this connection with a lot of people in a lot of different fields, is it's not about the money. Like, it's great to make money. It's great to have accolades. But at the end of the day, you just have to want to be one of those people. You just have to want to be, you know, whatever it is, the director or the comic book artist or whatever it is you're out to do, right? You have to want it so badly that logic no longer plays a part. And you have to start marching in the direction of your dream, even though you don't know how you're going to arrive at the finish line. You don't know. That's the thing. And you have to accept that you don't know, or at least I did, because if you sit there and try to figure everything out, you never get off the couch. You never actually get into motion.
Yeah.
And you know, the business that I built was good training for that, because there was no way that I could have possibly known how we were going to make the rent, how we were going to, you know, get clients, how I was going to work on that many films in that short amount of time. There was no way to know other than you just start doing it. You just start going that way. And I think in my experience, like, making this movie was the same thing. And we didn't have, you know, everything that we needed in the beginning. I just had a certain amount of money. And so that's why we only shot part of the movie, and then we shot another part of the movie. And, you know, we had a strategic way to break it out, but I just started going the direction that I wanted to go. And I figured that, you know, despite what they say about not spending your own money and stuff like that,
yeah,
the reality is, in my experience, nobody ever gave it to me. Like,
sure.
You know, Steven Spielberg didn't walk into my living room and be like, "Oh, Micah, hey, I was wondering where you were, man. Like, yeah, we've been looking for you." So it's like I just had to start doing it kind of on my own. And then, you know, you find people to collaborate with and people who are willing to join up and help you along the way. And it's invaluable. But those people, too, they're not going to join you unless you're on the path. You have to be bold enough to be on the path and be the person who's willing to take that risk and go after what you want. So that's what we did.
That's pretty awesome. That's pretty inspiring, actually. That's great. So how long did it take you to sort of shoot this? You just mentioned that you shot it in different segments. You started shooting and then you would stop, and then were you doing it on weekends, vacations? Like, how did that work out?
Well, essentially what happened was we had our original shoot, which was up on location in Central California. Which was mainly a lot of the more acting driven scenes. Mm-hmm. And so a 16-day shoot, up in my hometown, which is called Merced.
Oh yeah.
And then, we came back to LA later that summer, and we had a shoot on a stage here in Los Angeles where we did a lot of the creature stuff, because, you know, basically because it's puppets, we knew that being on a stage environment was going to help us tremendously in having the control that we needed to be able to do that efficiently.
Sure.
And so then we had an 8-day shoot on the stage. And then this year we had two different small pickup shoots. So we had, we had a couple more days of like pickup creature stuff. We had a couple days of some location exteriors where we drove back up to Merced and got some exteriors of the houses and things. And then we had a couple days of these kind of like tribal elements that we needed to shoot, which is part of the backstory of the spider and stuff like that in terms of where it comes from. So yeah, that was the stuff we did this year. Nice. So yeah, it was most of it, the majority of it was shot back in 2016. And then we had some small pickups this year.
And you were able to sort of preserve continuity between all these different shoots as opposed to having them all in one shoot?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think we did that pretty effectively, and it just took, you know, planning and keeping the costumes and praying that the actors remain the same and, you know, tested, you know, making sure that before I went to a shoot that everyone's haircut matched and.
So the spiders are they all practical? They're all puppetry, or are you using CGI, or is it's all practical?
Yeah, well, essentially, you know, I mean, when I was running the post-production studio, I mean, the advisement that my partner and I always gave people, especially on independent movies, but I think it goes for any movie, which is you do everything you can practically first, because it gives you kind of a nice base mm-hmm. of reality. Because any time that you have something fake in a scene or in a movie, the audience is looking at that thing to try to pick it apart. And sure. So the more that it has an actual physical reality with, you know, proper light, the way that the light hits it, the way that it looks, the way that it moves, it just has a more realistic texture. And so, yeah, we used essentially a variety of puppets to create all the different shots that we needed. You know, we planned it out. We planned exactly what we needed to do for the story, you know, for the scene. And then it's basically taking that shot and figuring out, okay, what rig would allow us to get that shot and how would we do that? And then we engineered it from there like a magic trick or something. And then essentially there will be some CGI, which is mainly rod removal and, compositing, you know, putting it into scenes or removing something out of a scene. And then we'd use CG for enhancement. So in other words, if it needed a little bit more dexterity than it had on the day, if it needed a little more texture or movement on some part of it, then we can add that added detail with computers. But we don't want to build the whole thing in CGI because it just doesn't look real. I mean, especially on a budget like ours, you know, we definitely don't have the money to spend millions of dollars on making a spider that ultimately is just going to look like a cartoon.
So that's interesting to me because I remember when CG kind of like first broke on the scene. I'm that old, obviously. I remember Jurassic Park, and I remember mm-hmm. like all, you know, Terminator 2. And the big thing was that CG was going to make everything cheaper. And it's sort of the same thing with comics. It was like, oh, we've got this thing called Photoshop now, and it's going to make everything cheaper and, you know, make things more efficient. And it seems that things have sort of kind of gone the other way.
That's
so
right.
Do you think is practical sort of like less expensive in its own way than full CG or and why is that?
I mean, look, it all costs money.
Sure.
And so I don't like, I do think ultimately it is cheaper, but it all costs money and there's no way to not have CG. But it's like, you know, you bring up Terminator 2. They had something like 40 CG shots. Okay.
Oh, really?
And I mean, in a standard movie these days, and I'm talking like a romantic comedy will have 100 CG shots.
Really?
Right. And I don't mean all CG, but I mean like you'll have 100 visual effect shots that are cleaning up this or adding this or doing that. I mean, you know, we did it all the time at my company. And you know, we were working on these small little indies that supposedly had no visual effects. And yet we were doing, you know, hundreds of shots per picture sometimes because there's little mistakes, and then people say, oh, we'll fix it in post. And so it's just what it's created is, you know, and this isn't coming from a place of me being a hater, but it's created kind of a lazier approach sometimes.
Sure, sure.
To where rather than trying to get it right on set in terms of the lighting or in terms of an effect or something like that, it's easier to just say, oh, we'll fix it later somehow. But it's not realistic. That's not really how visual effects work their best. How visual effects work their best is you've done everything you can to do it, and then you know where you've fallen short, and then where you've fallen short and where you literally can't figure out a way to do it any other way. That's what you do with visual effects. And then you have something photoreal. And that's why those early movies that you mentioned, like Jurassic Park and Terminator 2, there's tons of practical effects in Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Tons. Because they literally did everything they could do with practical effects, and then only the things that they couldn't do with practical effects, they did with computers. Yeah. And I think the results speak for themselves. I mean, I think those films like Terminator 2 and Jurassic Park still stand out as some of the best examples of computer graphics, and that's because they were used appropriately and sparingly.
It's really interesting that you say that there's sort of, I don't know if like laziness is the term that you used or something like that. But I mean, in my professional life, I mean, I use Photoshop a lot. And there have definitely been times where I've come across like imagery or images and stuff like that, where I'm like, do we even need good photographers anymore? Like, you know, you're given something and I'm like, how was I given this? You know, like, did this person know how to use a camera? And then it's, you know, part of my job to go in and make it look nice or make it look better or at least presentable. And it's interesting because I sort of remember, I can't remember if it's like Keanu Reeves produced a documentary about digital versus film or something like that. I think it was on Netflix for a while, and I cannot remember the name of it. But when it came out, like, everyone was like super excited about it. And I watched it, and there were a lot of people talking about sort of like cinematography and saying, like, you know, the art of cinematography is somewhat disappearing now because people are like, well, if the lighting's off or whatever, like, we don't care, we'll just fix it.
Right.
And you would get cinematographers, they interviewed a couple of cinematographers, and like, why am I working my ass off to get this beautiful lighting that I wanted? And then you're just taking it into the, you know, the color correction, and you're just changing it into something else. So it's interesting to me that sort of, and you can sort of see that in a way with a lot of big budget stuff where it's just like all CGI, and you're just like, what happened to the story? And is even a lot of that stuff even there? You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I totally understand. Yeah. I mean, I think that there are still a lot of great artists.
Oh, sure.
Working in film. However, I completely understand what you're saying. I mean, I think it's this interesting catch 22, because it's great that equipment of all kinds, whether it's production or post-production, have become so ubiquitous where it's like anybody can get their hands on it and make something. I mean, that's fantastic. And yet, there is, in some cases, not in all cases, but in some cases, there's less diligence put into the actual training, you know, of the craft. And I think people want to skip over parts of that process. And I mean, I think you see it everywhere from directors to writers to editing to, you know, director of photography, like all these things. You can see people that were able to leapfrog over it, and something is lost. You know, something is lost by not being able to go through those levels of training. But I also understand it in that it's a strange system. It's hard to break in some ways, and so in order to get the job you want, sometimes you just have to start doing it. So yeah, I don't know what the answer is, but there definitely is a lost art, and I think when it comes to visual effects, there's something to be said for studying those old school techniques that a lot of people don't do anymore. And I don't just mean practical effects going back to the 80s. I mean, there's been visual techniques that go visual effects techniques that go back to Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or silent movies before then. I mean, there's visual effects techniques that go back a long ways. And I think really understanding some of those on a basic level is incredibly helpful. It's just another tool for filmmakers to use and build upon. And you can use modern techniques in a more effective way, I think, if you start to understand how some of those things work in principle.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because horror, obviously, I mean, 70s, 80s, whatever, has generally sort of been more of like a low budget enterprise. And it sort of like leads a lot of directors to sort of up their game creatively. And there's definitely sort of, I mean, obviously there are still sort of that lower budget horror and, you know, things. And like you've said, there's tons of CGI or visual effects that we're not even supposed to notice to help clean things up. But it's interesting to me how horror, like you said, is sort of like looked down upon, but it is also the place where a lot of innovation in filmmaking seems to have come from.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's a very valid point, and I agree. I mean, it's really a great training ground because it is so forgiving in a certain way. I mean, if you have imagination and you have a willingness, you can make something really interesting that could catch on and could deliver, you know, what fans of the genre want. And that's a hopeful thing for an independent filmmaker who is having trouble getting something made, having trouble getting their career started. It's a place where they can start and be noticed.
Yeah. Definitely. And it's obviously been sort of the gateway for a lot of directors to maybe start off in horror or use a horror movie to sort of revitalize their career, that sort of thing. So what is it about, besides the obvious answer, what is it about the spiders that sort of made you keep going back to that idea? Because, I mean, obviously spiders themselves are creepy and gross. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, what is it about this story that to you just kept wanting to come back to? Because we haven't really mentioned the plot at all. And I don't know if you want to, you know, spoilers. But, I mean, what is it about this story that just made you keep wanting to go back, and couldn't let go of it?
I mean, it started with the high concept. I had this very specific idea of the high concept of the way that this spider would behave, the realism of it, the size of it, because, you know, I think it's kind of ridiculous to me. It's at least humorous, I'll put it that way, to see a gigantic lumbering spider, which I've seen a lot. And then I've also seen normal sized spiders a lot, but I wanted this specific size of like a small dog where it could still behave like, you know, in a way that has everything that's frightening about spiders. And you get this oversized look at it, which if you've ever looked at a spider under a magnifying glass, it's pretty horrifying. It looks like a creature from outer space or something.
I'm not going to do that. No, that's...
It's disturbing on a really deep level that's probably, you know, baked into our DNA. So,
yeah.
I wanted to have all those features that I thought were frightening, but at this very specific size that I thought would be cinematic. And then the character drama kind of grew out of that. You know, it's always been really easy for me. Maybe it's my vivid imagination, but it's very easy for me to come up with horrific scenes or suspense sequences. And that was never the hard part of the writing process. The hard part of the writing process for me was being able to live up to what my hopes were in terms of the actual character drama, because I wanted it to be a character drama first and a suspense thriller or horror film secondary to that. Because like I say, it was a no-brainer for me to come up with those things, but I wanted it to have these strong characters and even kind of have edgy characters, you know, like some of the movies that I like from the 70s where they challenged you a little bit with the drama. It wasn't just like everything was rosy and worked out okay. There were there were, you know, things that made you think, and there were things that maybe made you uncomfortable. And I think that works really well in horror films too, because, you know, explaining things, which, you know, sometimes there's an overabundance of in certain movies.
Sure.
Actually ruins horror. You know, I think what's great about horror, and what I was taught in terms of what's effective in horror, is, you know, things that are uncanny, things that are unexplained, you know, that's more frightening. It's more unsettling. And so we kind of tease at those things in terms of having a mythology, which having that kind of a baseline mythology is something that kind of grounds a horror film and connects all the pieces. But then, like I say, we wanted this great character drama. And so basically our story is, we have a young single mother who experienced some loss and tragedy in her past, and she's taking her two children to move from New York City out to a more rural area to live in the guest house and look after this elderly art appraiser named Walter, played by Bruce Davison.
That's awesome that you got Bruce Davidson in there. He's a fantastic actor.
Yeah, he's great. He's great. He's just fantastic. He, you know, every day coming to work with him was a pleasure. I mean, all the actors did a tremendous job, but yeah, we were really lucky to have him, and just the amount of energy that he puts into his characters. You know, all the different conversations that we had, he doesn't just let things go. He really wants to talk about it. He really wants to understand every line and every scene, and has strong opinions about it. And, you know, as he should. I mean, the guy's worked on over 250 movies,
yeah.
Academy Award nominee. You'd think he learned a few things.
Yeah, you'd think he knows something.
Yeah, yeah. So it was really, you know, it was really great to have that level of commitment from an actor of his stature, and it just made the film better. It just really elevated the movie to have him in it. But all the actors brought their A game, and we were, you know, very lucky to have Denise Crosby playing our sheriff, which we kind of did something interesting there where we made it a female sheriff. And I think it really spoke to Denise. You know, she was so great and also just so committed to the process, and brought so much subtlety to her role as the sheriff. I mean, it really struck a chord with me, and I think the part really struck a chord with her and meant something to her. And, you know, I don't want to speak for her, but I think it's really special. I think there's really something about special about her in that role. And but yeah, everyone was great. And so, yeah, we have this great character drama of this young mother being a fish out of water. And when the spider arrives, it arrives inside an art object that is tied to Walter's past. And so it gets released, and it's also a fish out of water. And so we kind of have this connection between the spider, which is also, you know, a physical embodiment of this spider goddess. And then we have our main female character, played by Elizabeth Roberts. And there's this sort of dark mirror reflection that they are of each other. And we use that as a structuring element in the film. And so it's really a story about mothers in a certain sense. And I think that we deal with some aspects of what you know, a psychologist might call the dark feminine, where it's kind of like you're playing with these darker ideas that are a little bit taboo. And again, I mean, I think that's something that you can easily get away with in horror films, to kind of, you know, go to territories that are a little bit edgy. You know, it's kind of playing with ambivalence and parenthood and
subtext,
you know, you really fill it with a lot of subtext. And so we tried to do that.
That's great. So when you get this funded, because you're going to get it funded, and you finish the project, do you want to keep making horror movies, or are you interested in branching out to different things? Are you like a horror fanatic where you're like, I just want to make more horror movies? Or is this sort of a thing that it's like, I made a horror movie, now I'll do something else? Or do you see yourself just making horror movies for a little bit while long? I mean, obviously nobody wants to narrow their career. It's kind of a stupid question, but are horror movies something that you see yourself like, are you like a Wes Craven type? That's just like, I'm going to keep making horror movies because that's what I really like, you know?
I mean, I love all kinds of movies. And so I definitely like movies that are surreal. And I like movies that have, you know, some kind of meaning that I feel strongly about. I'm not really interested in just making a movie to make a movie. It's just too difficult.
Sure.
But I'm not looking to hit people over the head with messaging. It just has to be something that I personally respond to and can live with for 2 to 5 years, because that's kind of what happens when you're making a movie is, you know, you don't get paid a lot, and there's a lot of behind the scenes work that go into making something that appears seamless. And so I have no problem making more horror movies. There's a lot of horror movies that I really like and that are, you know, beloved to me, but there's a lot of other movies too that I could get behind. And so I think it just really depends on what strikes my fancy.
Well, what are some of your favorite movies? Horror or otherwise?
Oh yeah.
What would you recommend to people, like you being a director of this indie spider movie, horror movie? What are some, you mentioned Citizen Kane. I mean, I think that's just a given for everybody, right? But
well, you know, it's one of those movies that because I don't know if it still is, but I know it was number one on the list of the greatest movies of all time by the Academy or AFI.
Yeah, it got replaced by Vertigo like last year or a year ago.
Oh, did it? Oh, yeah. Well, Vertigo.
I disagree, but anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, Vertigo's fantastic. So,
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think there was good reasoning behind Citizen Kane being number one, even though it wasn't a movie that I've watched the most in my lifetime.
Oh, sure.
But it definitely, it just has all these really interesting pieces, and I think was transformative to cinematic language.
Sure.
And so that's why I think it's such a standout picture.
Yeah, but we did episode on Citizen Kane a little while ago. Every once in a while, we do like film club movies on this podcast. And so I think we did Citizen Kane a while ago. Not that there were any like film scholars or anything like that, but we just watched it and it blew me away. Like, again, obviously I'd seen it before, but it's funny because the first time I saw it, I was a young man. And the ambition of Citizen Kane is kind of like what stuck out for me. And then now I'm sort of older, not like an old man by any means, but older, you know, sort of a little bit wiser. And I'm like, wow, this sort of like downfall of Citizen Kane, or the thing of like not having lived the life that you thought you were going to live, that was what kind of like really nailed me this time. So it's just interesting how a movie can affect you at different times in your life.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you can tell that even though he was a young man when he made it, there's this weird personal connection with Orson Welles in that movie. I mean, you know, it's sort of like he could never live it down in a certain sense. So yeah, it's a really fascinating movie on multiple levels. And, you know, technically too, I mean, the visual effects in that movie are, I mean, flawless. You can't even tell their visual effects.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but what are some of your favorites?
Well, it's funny because I actually had to do this today. Earlier today, I was on a podcast called Movies Made Me, where I had to come up with...
You were on another podcast?
I know.
How dare exactly. you?
Dare I? I'm How dare kidding. I? But I had to come up with other, you know, films that were transformative for me. So I had to kind of boil it down to... you know, 5 to 8 movies. And so, you know, I mean, I listed several, but I mean, I listed Star Wars for multiple reasons, Pulp Fiction for multiple reasons, Taxi Driver, Suspiria.
Oh yeah.
E.T., Interview with the Vampire and Videodrome.
Oh my God, that's so funny because I can't stand Interview with the Vampire. But
yeah, it's interesting because right now, you know, I don't watch Interview with the Vampire anymore. But when I was in high school, and I was telling this story. I mean, when I was in high school, I was kind of at a place where I didn't really want to be, and I felt very isolated. And there was something about that movie that, even though, I mean, it has this slightly depressing energy to it, but it made me feel better. It made me feel like, because they were experiencing a similar type of, I don't know, malaise, I guess, I could connect to that. I could understand it. And so it really, at that period of time, was it was just the right movie at the right time. And I think there's been a lot of movies like that for me at various points in my life where, you know, you can hit upon something that's just the perfect movie for you at that time.
Yeah, and absolutely.
It doesn't mean you keep watching it every year, but maybe one year you watch it 7 to 10 times. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's so funny because Interview with the Vampire is one of those things on Facebook with a friend of mine who loved the movie, and I just did not like it because I love the book. I just, Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt and long hair, it just didn't do it for me, but we're always like, every once in a while that'll come up and he'll be like, I love Interview with the Vampire. I'll be like, I hate Interview with the Vampire. And we'll just go back and forth and he'll be like, nope. And I'll be like, yep, I can't stand it. And he'll be like, nope, it's excellent. So it's just one of those funny things that you mentioned, Interview with the Vampire. That's so funny. But you know, can't beat Anne Rice though.
Oh, she's great. Yeah. And it's, you know, it speaks to the power of certain movies where it's like, you know, some movies are powerful because they're broad and they hit a broad audience, but some movies are powerful because they find their audience and there's just specific people who it feels so personal to them that it almost feels like they could have made it or, you know, it's just like the perfect movie for them. And there's plenty of other movies where I've had the same conversation with friends, and for them, you know, it's some other movie that at a certain time in their life was just the perfect movie and spoke to them, you know, almost like a friend. And you know, it just kind of, like I say, that's the impact that movies can have. So it doesn't really matter if it doesn't hit big, as long as it connects with even one person that way, then I think that artist has created something great.
Absolutely. And well, here's to hoping that Itsy Bitsy is that movie for a whole bunch of people. Everyone should definitely go on Kickstarter and fund Itsy Bitsy the movie, or itsybitsythemovie.com, correct?
Yeah. And you know, for fans of Nightmare on Elm Street, the Matthew Peake, the artist who did all the artwork for the Nightmare on Elm Street series, the original posters and box covers and stuff, he's doing our poster. So we're going to we've got a limited edition t-shirt and poster coming out designed by Matthew Peake and a bunch of other cool goodies on there.
That's amazing. Wow. You've really put yourself together a great project. I mean, it sounds like it's all coming together.
Yeah, we've tried, you know, and we've got a lot of great people working on it who are very committed. And so we're excited. I feel lucky, and we're glad to start to share that with the world.
Well, I'm glad to have been able to contributed a little bit of my money towards Itsy Bitsy.
Thank you.
And I really appreciate you coming on, Micah. It's great to talk to you, and you know, the movie looks, you know, fantastic to me. The trailer that I saw, you know, I mean, it just came up on Kickstarter. Again, like I said in the beginning of the podcast, I saw it and I was like, oh, this looks professional. I'm going to contribute, cool. You know, so congratulations. And I wish you all the luck in the world.
Awesome. Thanks. Yeah. Great talking to you. And I really appreciate your time, and thanks for having me on your show.
Absolutely. Well, we have been chatting with Micah Gallo, and he is the director of Itsy Bitsy the Movie. Go to Kickstarter and drop your money on Itsy Bitsy the Movie. Search for it there, or itsybitsythemovie.com. My name is Christian Horn. This has been another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. You can check us out on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, we're on Instagram, all that good social media stuff. And thank you for coming on, Micah. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. And hopefully we will be back soon with another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy. Part-time. Part-time fanboy.com.